Hey, everybody, this is Scott Weinberg, and we are back with a very special episode of Science Versus Fiction. As usual, I am joined by my friend and co-host, Dr. Stephen DeGennaro. Stephen, what are we going to be talking about this week?
Well, you and I spent most of last week watching a crap ton of movies at Fantastic Fest in Austin, and a good chunk of those were science fiction, either pure science fiction or science fiction related, or science fiction had science fiction elements. And so we thought we would do a rundown of the various movies that we saw, and a spoiler free rundown of what should be on your radar as sci-fi fans, and what we enjoyed. And
So that's it. Yep. As usual, the Fantastic Fest programmers are on point. Yeah, I think we both saw maybe one or two or maybe three movies we didn't love, but for the most part, the lineup was pretty great. I think this year's Fantastic Fest had a remarkably strong batting average. And we'll start out with a film that's only tangentially sci-fi because, well, it relates to drugs and blood. Stephen, what did you think of Joey Bagos' Bliss?
So I actually didn't see this at Fantastic Fest. I got to see it at Fright Fest a week or two before, and I got to see it on a 60-foot screen. So for those of you who don't know, Bliss is about a young artist, a female artist, who discovers a drug, a new drug called Bliss, and simultaneously also may or may not have been turned into a vampire. And it's extreme on almost every level, just in terms of the gore, in terms of the aesthetic and the camera work, and it's a sensory assault, and it was, and I mean that in a good way, and I was really, really glad that I got to see that on a big screen. It's actually out now. It's playing theaters around the country at the moment, and so if
and
you
VOD,
have a chance to
I believe.
See this, yeah.
Yep.
Well, but I want to say is that if you have a chance to see this on a big screen, absolutely take it, because it's a, like I said, it's a sensory experience.
And Fantastic Fest, they showed it in 35, which was cool.
Yeah, so I didn't see it in 35. I saw the DCP, but I saw it on a 60-foot screen, and you know, they shot it on 16mm. It's got this grainy, it's got a very sort of Darren Aronofsky meets Gaspar Noé kind of feel to it.
For the horror fans, I'd say it's mid-era Abel Ferrara, like during his New York phase.
Okay.
Like Driller Killer, Miss 45, stuff like that. But yeah, it's good. I liked it, and I'm always looking forward to what Joey has next. He actually had a second film at Fantastic Fest, which is in no way related to science fiction, but I will throw in a little plug for VFW. It is a raucous, energetic action film in which several elderly actors, including Stephen Lang, Bill Sadler, and Fred Williamson, have to fight off a bunch of drug-addicted punks from inside of a VFW post, which is basically a bar for veterans. And it's not sci-fi at all, but still kind of fun. Keep an eye out for VFW. Stephen, what did you see that is sci-fi?
So my first movie of the festival was a movie called Vivarium with Jesse Eisenberg, which I don't think you saw. Am I right?
I did not. Please elucidate us.
So Vivarium it's rides the line between sort of fantasy and science fiction. It's hard to say too much about it without spoiling it, but basically Jesse Eisenberg and his wife are looking for a new house to move into, and they get taken to this very weird sort of caricature of a suburban neighborhood where literally every single house is the same, every single street looks the same, every blade of grass is mowed to exactly 2.84 inches. All of the houses appear to be empty, and they get shown around this house by this very weird real estate agent who then disappears, and they are unable to find their way out of the neighborhood.
That's it. Yeah, that's basically the premise. And it stars Jesse Eisenberg and Imogen Poots, and both very interesting actors. I was disappointed that I missed this one. Stephen, does it work? Is it an interesting social commentary?
It is absolutely worth watching. Like I said, I don't know that it's necessarily science fiction. It becomes more sort of allegorical as things wear on. It's got a very sort of Charlie Kaufman-esque kind of feel to it in some ways. In its quirkiness.
It's an indictment of conformity, yes?
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially like, to me, honestly, as a 42-year-old guy who lives in the suburbs with his family, and I don't necessarily have anything to base this on, I don't know the filmmaker, but to me it felt a little bit like a younger person's idea of what that feels like.
Yeah.
And now that I'm actually living it, I at 25, I probably would have been fully on board with this movie and its, you know, sort of dystopic view of what it looks like to be an adult raising children in the suburbs. Now that I'm actually living it, it's, you know, it doesn't feel like a dystopia to me. So it didn't quite land with me probably as much as with some other people. But
that's just because you're in the maze, man. You're just a rat.
Exactly.
You're the rat in the maze. Of course you don't see the maze.
Maybe I'm one of the people it's criticizing. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was enjoyable. It was certainly worth watching. It was very interesting. The production design was spectacular. They did a lot of stuff with what appeared to, I think they did a lot of it with miniatures and green screen, and there wasn't a whole lot of CGI in it. And they really built this environment in a way that felt like you were living in a diorama, which was really, really interesting.
Cool.
I liked it a lot.
Cool, cool. Looking forward to Vivarium. I will move on to a film I know that you saw later in the festival, but I saw it early. This is Jason Lee Howden's Guns Akimbo. If anybody out there will remember from a few years back, a rockin' horror comedy called Deathgasm. It's the same director, and he's back. This is Daniel Radcliffe as a, calls himself like an internet anti-troll, who hops onto social media and gaming sites and starts fights with right-wing pundits. He starts arguments, and he does this from the safety of his own couch. And then eventually, one of the organizations that he messes with breaks into his apartment and literally bolts guns to his hands and then forces him to fight in an online death match against Samara Weaving.
Yeah, a citywide online death match.
Citywide, yeah. It's insane. And I think the energy flags a few times, and I think it sometimes loses its focus a little. But for the most part, I had a really good time with this. I don't know if I would have had as much of a good time, say, if I watched it on a screener on a Tuesday night by myself. But early in the festival with a receptive crowd, we had a lot of fun with Guns Akimbo, and I will watch it again eventually, but for right now, firm recommendation.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it's a movie that was enhanced considerably by watching it with a crowd, but I don't think it needed that enhancement. I think it reminded me a lot of a previous Fantastic Fest screening, Mom and Dad, a couple years back, which I had an absolute blast watching. The crowd was totally into it. The movie is, I don't know that I agree with you that it ever flags. I think it pretty much hits the pedal to the floor. It's very much, you know, like Crank in terms of its energy, in terms of its just forward drive.
It is a bit like Crank. I just think maybe it's inevitable because when a movie starts with such oomph and such energy, it almost feels like any time they slow down, like in Act Two, that it flags a bit. And I think,
I would say that the slow parts of this movie are still faster than, you know,
yeah.
99% of movies out there.
Howden and his editor and his sound people, they cut the movie to pop songs. Like there are action sequences that are literally cut to the beat of like Dead or Alive's You Spin Me Round, Baby, Baby, Right Round, Like a Record, Steven, Right Round, yeah. Round.
So similar to Baby Driver
in that regard. Yep, it has a little bit of that DNA, clearly inspired at least a little bit by that, surely.
Yep.
And it is a little bit mindless, a little bit derivative of other, you know, post-apocalyptic type world.
It is hyper-violent, so if you're not into that sort of thing.
And hyper-violent, kinetic, but fun. I definitely enjoyed it, and keep an ear out for Guns Akimbo.
I thought it was a huge step up for him. You know, obviously it was a huge step up for him in terms of budget and ambition, but in terms of his, yeah, and cast, it, you know, but in terms of just the raw filmmaking ability on display here, I mean, I enjoyed Deathgasm, but this to me, like, is the work of somebody who's going to be a big action director.
Definitely recommended, Guns Akimbo. Steven, what'd you see next?
So I got to see, finally, after many years of trying to track it down, what is considered by many, including myself, to be the actual first found footage horror movie. It's called The McPherson Tape. It predates The Blair Witch Project by a decade. It was literally shot on VHS in a single unbroken take, although there are a few cuts in the movie where they apparently shortened it for time purposes. It is a movie that was very difficult to get a hold of. It didn't really get any sort of distribution. It sort of landed with a dull thud.
Yep, I've never seen it. I didn't see it at Fantastic, and I still have yet to see it.
Well, so he went on, the person who made this tried to sell it. People weren't interested. And then it apparently, somebody lopped off the opening and closing credits and started circulating it amongst UFO enthusiast. So the movie is about this family, and the son in the family just got a new VHS video camera, and he's shooting a birthday party when there's strange lights and noises outside, and they go out to investigate, and they discover an alien craft and little green men coming out of it. And then the rest of it is quite a bit of a siege sort of thing where they're in the house, and these aliens are kind of trying to get in.
Okay, so as a person who both appreciates found footage format and has directed a found footage film, how is it on a technical level?
I mean, on a technical level. Well, so I think it's unfair to judge found footage movies on a technical level. I will say that, weirdly enough, despite the fact that it predates the big found footage movie that sort of started all of the cliches of found footage, it hits a surprisingly large number of found footage cliches, or what would become cliches, which in a sense sort of illustrates how a lot of what has ossified as cliches in found footage movies is not so much people ripping off other things as much as it is creators coming to the same solutions for common problems. So it's a very sort of unique way to shoot a movie. And, you know, there's...
So what you're saying is that you've discovered some of the original cliches in a film that a lot of found footage filmmakers have not seen this movie. And therefore, the idea of, for example, the cliche of somebody having to explain why we're still shooting.
Yep.
That would be required in just about any.
Right.
It's not somebody ripping off a cliche. It's somebody literally addressing the inherent issue.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, the movie, it's interesting. It's interesting as a sort of relic of a
historical document. Yeah, historical, horror.
Exactly. So he went on to remake this movie. So they couldn't sell the original one. It started circulating amongst UFO enthusiasts, some of whom to this day insist that it's real and that him claiming that he made it is some sort of smokescreen by the Illuminati or whatever.
So would you recommend horror and sci-fi fans dig this up or no?
If you like found footage movies like I do, I would definitely, it's, you know, again, it's for completeness sake, I wouldn't necessarily watch it for entertainment value, although it is often funny and so occasionally in ways that are intentional and a lot of ways that aren't necessarily, just that it was hampered by the budget and the level of the acting that was available to them. It's definitely worth watching, again, for completeness sake, but not something I would definitely wouldn't recommend it to somebody that doesn't like found footage movies.
Yeah, I want to check it out like as a forensic movie pathologist, you know, even if it's not great, I do want to chart all the origins of different genres. And I haven't heard of this, but I'd never seen it. So I'm curious to check it out. Now, what about the remake?
I have not seen the remake. So the remake was apparently done with a much bigger budget. So they shot this for like $6,000, something like that. And then this company decided to give them money to shoot a remake of it for $1.5 million in like 1990 or something like that. And the director at the Q&A said like he didn't know what he could possibly spend that much money on. So they ended up sort of shooting talking head interviews and reenactments and then sort of found footage. And so apparently the remake, which aired on Canadian television, I believe, was sort of a melange of found footage and interviews that treated it as if it was real.
Right. So even then, with the talking heads, you're still seeing early origins, still early examples of staples of the genre.
Yep.
Yeah. Pretty cool. McPherson Tapes. Good. Fantastic Fest is good at digging up weird, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but always interesting relics. And we're going to switch right over to another relic. It's a film about a scientist who puts a teenager's brain into the body of an animatronic Tyrannosaurus Rex. Steven, did you sit down and watch the repertory screening of Tammy and the Teenage T-Rex?
I unfortunately missed that one. It was up against a couple things I wanted to see, but I am looking forward to the Doug Benson interruption someday of this movie because I think it would be fantastic.
All right, well, here's a little historical context for our friends. This Tammy and the T-Rex, as it is otherwise known, came out in 1994. It is a film from the writer-director Stuart Raffle, who old bad horror film aficionados will recognize Stuart Raffle's name because he directed Mannequin on the Move. He directed The Ice Pirates. He also directed the infamously wretched Mac and Me, all before he got to Tammy and the T-Rex, which stars the late Paul Walker and a very young Denise Richards. And he is wooing her. She has a psycho ex-boyfriend, and there is a mad scientist running around. After a ridiculous accident in which the bully and his gang leaves Paul Walker alone in an animal refuge, and he is killed by a lion. Terry Kaiser, a.k.a. Bernie from Weekend at Bernie's, takes his brain and puts it into the body of an animatronic T-Rex. That makes no sense.
Wait. In the world of the movie, the T-Rex is animatronic, or you're just saying
yeah.
that they
use No. In the universe of the world, it is acknowledged as a robotic dinosaur. Yet a human brain goes all up into it.
This.
Yeah. And it is both, you know, Stuart Raffel's not a great filmmaker, but nor is he an imbecile. He knows this is being played for broad, silly humor. And it occasionally lands on that target. And then sometimes it just, you know, just bad. Even if you're making something intentionally wacky, you know, there's a lot of downtime there. And there are some legitimately funny ideas and sight gags and decent special effects. The young Denise Richards is beautiful. Paul Walker, he looks a bit like he's about 12. And the animatronic dinosaur is fairly nifty. But the most interesting thing about this repertory screening, Stephen, is that when Tammy and the T-Rex was released in 94, it had a PG-13.
Well, because the studio thought that, like, well, there's an animatronic dinosaur, so, like, we got to make it a kid's movie.
But the lunatic film archivist at a company called Vinegar Syndrome came across the original cut of this film, which is definitely rated R, in that it is really bloody and gory. There is more raunch and vague sex stuff. And I had never seen the PG-13 version, but I can't imagine it being any better than this. This is insane. It's absolutely nuts. And it will be available, and I will promote them again. If you follow Vinegar Syndrome on Twitter, they will give you all the information. It will be available, I believe, at the end of October or November, later this year, for only a limited period of time, for like a week. So if you want to see this obscure, ridiculous relic, go follow Vinegar Syndrome and tell them Scott and Steve sent you. But yeah, that's just a little piece of insanity. And as much as I like seeing new films, I always see one or two repertory screenings at Fantastic Fest. And while this movie was, if I was watching it on Netflix by myself, I'd probably make it like an hour and then turn it off and think, oh, I'll finish it later. But it's so insane and so goofy that it fit in perfectly at Fantastic Fest, and I had fun with it.
So I'm going to pivot pretty much 180 degrees away from Tammy and the T-Rex to a movie called The Long Walk by a fantastic filmmaker, no pun intended, and a Fantastic Fest regular, Matty Doe, who lives in Laos and shot the movie in Laos. It is a very sort of slow, meditative, but not in a bad way.
Film critics don't say slow in a good way. We say deliberate. That makes it sound good.
It's very deliberately paced. No, but see, oftentimes when in the, especially at Fantastic Fest, if I see deliberately paced in the description, I'm like, all right, I'm going to skip that one, because often that means so painfully slow that you want to gnaw your own arm off to get away. This was not that. This was held my interest all the way through. It was very exceptionally well made. It's a character piece. So the gist of it is, without giving too much away, the main thrust of the story takes place in 64-ish. It's, you know, some unspecified future time. And an old man who apparently has spent his entire life talking to this ghost woman that follows him around the town. So he's incredibly poor. I don't know. He's not really a farmer. Yeah, I guess he is a farmer. He grew up incredibly poor on a farm in Laos. And he has spent his life talking to this ghost woman, and she somehow develops the ability to put him in contact with his 8-year-old self via what is sort of time travel, but sort of mystical. And so it's definitely has elements of science fiction, because it takes place, the main story takes place in the future. And there are, you know, tech elements, like he has a chip embedded in his arm that he uses to pay for things or to answer phone calls and that kind of stuff. And so there's a lot of sci-fi elements in that. And then there's the sort of sci-fi-ish element of the time travel. And so he now can sort of interact with his younger self and shape. It's essentially about his attempt to sort of correct a few traumatic things that happened in his childhood in order to make him not the person that he is now. And of course, it's time travel, so there are unintended consequences all over the place. And so
Maddie was a Fantastic Fest regular before she became a filmmaker. This is her third feature. She did one in 2012 called Chantali, and then I saw in 2016 Dearest Sister played Fantastic Fest. I like that very much. The Long Walk I was unable to catch, but I'm sure somebody's going to pick it up for U.S. distribution, and I'm going to watch it immediately, because not only do I think she's a very good filmmaker, but I think she's a great person. I absolutely love Maddie, and I'm really glad that you liked it and that it qualifies as sci-fi so that we can give her some love here. She also produced a film that played Fantastic Fest a while back called River, and I like that.
That is
too.
One of my favorite Fantastic Fest movies ever.
Yeah.
Yep. So good.
And she's somebody who knows her horror and also hails from a part of the world that doesn't make a lot of films, let alone genre films. So therefore, I believe that Maddie Doe's work is worthy of a spotlight. And thank you for mentioning it, Stephen. It's called The Long Walk. And no, Stephen King fans, it has no connection to the wonderful dark short story, novella, The Long Walk. But the title is the same. All right. From there, we are going to move on to a really interesting indie sci-fi film that was picked up by Amazon prior to the festival. Stephen, let's talk about The Vast of Night.
All right, so this was my favorite movie at the festival, bar none. I absolutely loved every minute of it.
This one took me a little while to get into. I think I didn't love it quite as much as the general viewer, because this one was one of the most talked about films at the festival. Day 3, 4, 5, and you're just sitting in the trenches with your movie nerd friends, either outside or sitting in the theater waiting for something to start. The Vast of Night came up, like, what are your top three favorites? The Vast of Night comes up a lot. And I look forward to watching it again, because I definitely liked it, but I was kind of taken aback by how enthusiastic everybody else was about it. And I think maybe I might have been a little crabby or sleepy that night, and that might have waned some of my enthusiasm for it.
Well, let me tell you what I found so enthusiastic about it then.
Yep.
This is a film by a first-time filmmaker, first-time feature filmmaker. In fact, not just a first-time feature filmmaker. This is his first credit on IMDb, although apparently he has directed commercials.
Yeah, this guy's definitely got some experience. Oh, yeah. It might not be features or shorts, but this guy has shot stuff.
But one of the things that a lot of commercial/music video directors get wrong when they try to transition to features is characters and character work. And, you know, it becomes about the visuals, and they have a very hard time sort of telling a good story. And
all right, what's The Vast of Night about, Steve?
So The Vast of Night is about it takes place in the 50s in a small town, and most of the town is watching a basketball game that night. Like, literally almost the entire town is watching the basketball game that night. And so our main characters, who are a radio DJ, a young man, a teenager, and his teenage female friend, who runs she's the operator. So this is the 50s. So she literally runs the switchboard. And over the course of this evening, so she discovers a strange signal coming through on the switchboard and asks him to check it out. He broadcasts it out over the radio, and they get a phone call in, and it sets them off on this journey to discover whether or not this signal that they're getting is coming from some sort of alien life form in the town at that moment. And it's all framed in this sort of wraparound thing as like a fake episode of
like a Twilight Zone style.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the exact name of the
show was. Oh, I forget, but it was pretty clever.
Yeah, but it's very much, you know, Outer Limits, Twilight Zone sort of thing. The production design is impeccable. The cinematography is amazing. I mean, the performances are really, really good. It feels very real in a way. It feels very much like, okay, this is what, if there were aliens visiting a small town in the 1950s, this is sort of what, you know.
It feels like to me, remember the film from a few years ago called Midnight Special?
I have not seen that, but.
Oh, it's really good. It reminds me a bit of like Midnight Special if it was directed by Robert Altman as a period piece, because it deals with some really interesting sci-fi stuff, but it's also very much of its 50s era. And the Altman connection is the first third of this movie has characters talking at an unbelievably rapid clip.
During long tracking shots, which is also a very sort of Altman-esque thing.
And it's like Gilmore Girls-y in a way. And I think it might have just been that I wasn't used to. And that set me in a little bit of, what?
Well, so at the beginning, it was a little weird. So there's this, you know, it opens with this long tracking shot through a basketball game.
And a really amazing tracking shot, frankly.
Stunning.
Even if you can't stand the movie, this technically proficient as all hell.
But one of the issues with that took me, you know, I think I got into it quicker than you did, but one of the issues with that was that there was a whole lot of dialogue happening at the same time as this amazing visual thing was happening, and my brain sort of had a little difficult time concentrating on both at the same time.
I also think I have a hard time with, I guess, the stylized dialogue when my brain is constantly telling me, people don't talk like that. And then the other half of my brain going, dude, they talk like that in this movie. Get deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly stylized dialogue. It's meant to sort of evoke this sort of 50s era sci-fi
banter
movie dialogue. Yeah.
Staccato kind of rhythm.
But I think the chemistry between the two leads was fantastic.
It's Jake Horowitz and Sierra McCormick, both great. Both absolutely great.
And, I mean, it's definitely a movie that you're going to want to seek out. We were told that it's got a 2020 release. It was picked up by Amazon. Obviously, it'll be on Amazon at some point, but the director hinted also that there might be some sort of theatrical release involved, which I hope there will be, because I want to take my wife to go see it, and I think everybody should take their wives to go see it.
This is a movie that I definitely look forward to seeing again, because it seems like the kind of sci-fi film where I'll be able to say in 5 or 10 years, yeah, first time I saw it, it didn't really click, and then I fell in love. The second, you know, like, that happens a lot. So definitely recommended The Vast of Night. Steven's favorite, and impressed me in a lot of ways, too. Maybe not on a personal, like, loved it level, but definitely impressive. Then we move on to something that I was very personally interested in, because it's inspired by one of my favorite authors, the deceased and very problematic H.P. Lovecraft, and it stars one of my very favorite living actors, the wonderful, amazing, not being insincere, totally serious, love Nicholas Effing Cage. This is Color Out of Space. Steven, why don't you tell our listeners that funny little Color Out of Space story from earlier this year?
So, yeah, about a year ago, I get Scott and I are on the phone, and we're working on a script together that is very sort of Lovecraftian, I guess. And he said, you have to go read this story, Color Out of Space. It's my favorite Lovecraft story, and it's a thing that I have have always wanted to adapt into a film at some point. And so I went that night, and I went and I read Color Out of Space, and I was like, I can see what you're talking about. I can see how this relates to the script that we're writing. It's very Lovecraftian in that sort of uncanny, eerie, like, this thing is not just something that we don't understand, but it's beyond human understanding. And so about 2 months later, Spectrevision announced that they were doing this with Nicolas Cage and Richard Stanley, which was, I think, bittersweet for Scott, because he has always wanted to adapt this, but also that's a freaking great team of people to make a movie. So,
yeah, yep. And it just, on one hand, it is like, well, you know, you weren't ever really going to make this adaptation, so it's no real loss. On the other hand, it just shows me that other people out there have passions that share the same obsessions that I do. Color Out of Space is, of course, based on an old story by Lovecraft, and it's about a meteorite that crash lands in a farmer's yard and leads to all sorts of problems, both biological and psychological and metaphysical and all kinds of different adjectives. Are those adjectives?
Yeah.
Yes. And it works as both a visceral kind of gut punch, ew, that's gross, what happens to them, horror movie. But on another level, there's many different ways you could take it. You know, the dissolution of the American family unit, and, you know, how the passage of time causes rifts and animosity that sometimes can't be overlooked. And I think that Richard Stanley, who horror fans will know from good films like Hardware and Dust Devil, and bad films like the infamous Island of Dr. Moreau with Val Kilmer and Marlon Brando, to see him given a decent budget and producers who are confident in him to just do something interesting, I think that Lovecraft fans will really respond to this. It is a modernization of the story. It is not an entirely faithful adaptation. It takes place in modern day, and it does change a lot of the characters. And Lovecraft experts will appreciate that the hero of the film is a black man. And that was asked during the Q&A, and people just roared with approval when the Richard Stanley says, yeah, not accidental, because as much as I love his work, we'd be remiss if we didn't cite that Lovecraft was a notorious racist. So to see an adaptation in which women, he was not very fond of women either, in which women and a black man are not only impactful but heroic is a smart, clever move from the filmmakers. And even if you know none of that, it's just a cool, creepy sci-fi horror story. Steven, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I really, really enjoyed it. Obviously, it's a very well-crafted movie. I almost kind of wish you hadn't made me read the short story, because it's fresh enough in my memory that I was able to see all of the ways that it was changed. And some of them, you know, you understand the need for, and some of them, I think, detracted a little bit. I think there's something, I don't know, maybe to me that feels like there's something inherently period about Lovecraft stories, that when you take it out of that period, it feels like it's not, it's these mystical elements feel like they belong in a
time. Yeah, it's like a lot of Lovecraft stories feel like they should have the disclaimer 140 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, like it just seems to have this antiquated feel. I don't disagree. And I would love to have seen what Cage and Stanley and the Spectrevision guys and this really good cast could have done if they had said it in 1928. But they didn't. And I think it's a pretty good modernization. But I interrupted you. Keep going.
No, I mean, so that's, you know, basically what I was going to say. I think I was expecting something. I mean, you know, you hear Richard Stanley who did Hardware, which is definitely not a very conventional horror movie in a lot of ways. And Dust Devil, which is he never got to finish and was also not a very conventional horror movie. And this movie kind of felt oddly conventional given that it's a Lovecraft adaptation. And that's not the movie's fault. That's my expectations walking into it. I think I was expecting something more like Annihilation that is just sort of really, really out there and weird and doesn't explain a lot of stuff. And it felt more popcorn-y, and that's probably a good thing. But it was not what I was expecting in that regard.
Yeah, I think that's a fair observation. It's an indie film, and it has some nasty stuff in it, but it almost feels like one of the marching orders were, let's try and make it a bit more conventional than your average Lovecraft story. So maybe, you know, we bring in a couple extra viewers, but it is not a studio horror film by any stretch.
No.
All right.
Definitely worth seeking out, though.
But definitely recommended. We don't know when that'll be out, but I'll be tweeting about that as it gets closer. Steven, what do you got?
So this next one is not a science fiction film, but it is related to science fiction. And that was a fantastic documentary called Phil Tippett, Mad Dreams and Monsters.
Phil Tippett, Mad Dreams and Monsters. I had a ball with this. Yep. And it's not just because it is an artist whom I really admire. I'm going to let Steven cover this one, of course. But Phil Tippett, as most movie fans will know, is a motion capture and an artist, a puppeteer, a model maker for the original Star Wars trilogy, for Jurassic Park, RoboCop, Starship Troopers, Temple of Doom, Howard the Duck, that great monster at the end, Dragonheart. So many good films. And what I like about it is that it is in a catalog of his like greatest hits and greatest moments, but it's also a warm and affectionate look at a kind of non-traditional artist, in that he's not a guy who seeks the attention. He doesn't seek the spotlight. He's kind of a keep it to himself kind of guy. And I really appreciated learning more about him, not just his work, but about Phil himself.
Yeah, I mean, I almost feel like I would have liked for them to dive even more into sort of who Phil Tippett is as a person. I felt it was a lot about his work and a little bit about him as a person. And I mean, for me personally, I would have loved to know sort of a little bit more about what drove him. But by the same token, like just seeing the life that he's lived and seeing one of the things that I admire about him a lot is that he's an artist from two very, very different eras. Right, so his early stuff is all stop motion. It's very Ray Harryhausen, you know, tauntauns running through snow and AT-AT walkers and holographic chess pieces from Star Wars. And, you know, it's this very sort of handcrafted stop motion-y kind of thing, which, you know, when the doc sort of transitions, which is when movies transitioned, was that they were planning on doing that for Jurassic Park. And then Steven Spielberg saw the capabilities that computers were developing and decided he wanted to go with computers. And Phil sort of almost seamlessly made that transition. I imagine a lot of people in his position would have sort of been left behind, like a blacksmith at the end of the Iron Age.
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's a testament to his art and artistry that, I mean, if somebody came to you and said, oh, this one tool that you've been using for 30 years or 20 years, forget this tool, now learn this tool. But it's kind of the same result. You know, you're not going to use clay to make a dinosaur move anymore. You're going to use computer programs. And like Steven said, a lot of filmmakers at that point would go, ah, man, my craft is dead.
Yeah.
But A, stop motion will never, ever be truly dead. It's used a lot less, but it will never be dead. And B, Tippett was smart enough and gifted enough to like transfer his talent to a different tool.
Yeah. And what was amazing to me, which I did not know, was that when they did Jurassic Park, sort of he and the producers and Spielberg insisted that they were kind of bridge these two worlds. So they were going to render the dinosaurs as CGI, but they were going to animate them in this traditional way. And so they built these little rigs, they built these little dinosaurs, and they literally stop motioned the dinosaurs and used that data to define how the dinosaurs moved in the CGI world. And it was not a thing that I was aware of that that was how they had done it. And so it was very interesting to see that, but that transition. And then he, you know, became a digital artist. Essentially he, you know, I think they still use those tools somewhat now, but he started one of the first CGI effects studios essentially that's still going strong. And with the help of his wife and business partner.
There's another angle that I liked in the film is that his wife runs his studio, and they make no mistake that she keeps him focused. She is the boss. He, you know, he's the man with most of the talent as far as, you know, building the creatures. But more than one person says in the film, his success is thanks to her. And it's nice to see his wife get the kind of credit she deserves.
Yeah, she's the business side of things and he's the creative side of things. And that it's a, you know, a good partnership.
Yep, yep. All right, let's move on to a sci-fi film that we saw at Fantastic Fest. And it's already on Netflix. From director Jim Mickle, whom I adore. The guy has made We Are What We Are, Cold in July, and I'm forgetting one.
Skateland.
Stakeland.
Skateland. Very different movie. Stakeland.
Stakeland and Mulberry Street. Yeah, going all the way back. This is a Philadelphia set police procedural slash sci-fi story called In the Shadow of the Moon.
And how much of your enjoyment of this movie has to do with the fact that it's with Michael C. Hall's Philadelphia accent?
Oh, I love Michael C. Hall's Philadelphia accent in this movie. I've already seen people online making fun of it, and I do not care. I think this is a fun movie. I think it's a bit longer than it needs to be, with a little bit more exposition than it really needs. So to me, that's kind of, it's a bit more conventional than most of Jim Mickle's movies. But I think the cop stuff is pretty damn interesting. And I think the sci-fi angle, which evokes Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys, of all things, works. I had a good time with it. I think a little bit of the bias could be that it takes place in Philadelphia over four distinct decades, which means that the production designers and the costume designers had a lot of fun messing around with Philly. Some of the film was shot here. Some of it was shot in Toronto. But overall, I had a good time with this one. I thought it held together.
I mean, I enjoyed it. I didn't dislike the movie. I didn't love it as much as you did. I had some pretty severe issues with the science of the movie that I won't go into because I think it would be a little spoilerly. Maybe we'll cover this on a proper episode in the future. It felt as much like a police procedural to me as it does like a sci-fi movie, which is, again, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I love me some Law & Order SVU. But my major issue with the movie is, I'm trying to figure out if I can do this without spoiling the movie. The central conceit of this movie, like you said, it takes place over four decades, and there is apparently a time traveler who is going to each of these sort of decades in reverse. And so you can kind of track what's going to happen in the next segment by what happened in the one before it because of this reverse chronology thing. And so,
but not all of it. I tracked some of it, but there were still a few surprises for me.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I was ahead of the movie most of the way through, and so that hurt my enjoyment.
Yeah, and that's never a fun feeling because there's a lot of times you'd be like, this is well written, it's well shot, the actors are good, but I know everything in the next 20 minutes, and sometimes you're right, and that does kind of suck some of the wind out of a movie's sails.
Yeah, and there was a twist-ish in the last act that I didn't see coming, but also was not fully satisfied by. So, the craft on display obviously is impeccable. Mickle.
It's beautifully shot. It really is.
Mickle capped my single best festival day ever. I saw Grand Piano, Detective Downs, The Sacrament by Ty West, and then We Are What We Are by Jim Mickle at my first Fantastic Fest. And that's, I think, still the single best, like, four fantastic, no pun intended, movies in a single day.
Oy, I don't even know if I could ever. I'd have to really go back through the archives to pick out my very best Fantastic Day. I've been to 13 Fantastic Fests now. Steven, did you happen to catch a bizarre but very interesting Spanish film called The Platform?
I believe I was sitting next to you for that, was I?
I know. I was just doing it for the sake of the show.
We can't lie to our listeners.
All right, fine. Listen, everyone, I'm really sorry about that last lie. Steven sat right next to me while we watched The Platform, which is a bizarre but really interesting Spanish film that was acquired by Netflix. So not only did Netflix have some films at the festival that they produced, but there were also a few acquisitions. And The Platform is a really interesting thriller. It reminded me a bit of Vincenzo Natali's Cube from several years ago, in which people find themselves trapped in a mathematical puzzle and have to figure out how to get out there and what the puzzle means. And The Platform starts with two men waking up in a cell. In the middle of the room is an elevator that runs all the way up. Turns out that they're in a cell in a tower. And the tower goes up to 1 and goes all the way down to at least 200, but we don't know how far down the tower goes. And on the elevator platform is a huge feast of food. Now, the conceit of the film is that the food comes down every single day. Logically, the people at floor 1, floor 2, floor 5 will eat and eat well. But by the time the platform makes it down to 25, 50, 75, 100, there's not only no food left, but
no dignity.
Yeah. And it is obviously a political metaphor for the haves and the have-nots and how you should, you know, maybe reconsider your position if you happen to be doing well right now. Maybe consider helping people less off than you, because it won't take much for maybe fate to turn and you could find yourself in the situation one day where you are desperate for help. Because again, one of the conceits of the film is that every month the cellmates find themselves on a different level of the tower.
Random.
Yeah, random.
A random right, level.
Exactly. So it's, the movie is, you know, it wears the political metaphor and the subtext right there on its sleeve. But what I like a lot about it is that for the first half of the film, the kind of the political subtext or the sociological subtext of helping people who have less than you and trying to get help from the people who have more from you, that metaphorical stuff is very simple and delivered very plainly. But the longer the film goes, the darker and the smarter it gets. It really goes to some interesting places. And to say anything that happens in about the second half of the film would be a crime. So The Platform, definitely recommended, not for weak stomachs, but a really interesting, let's call it political thriller.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the production design was fantastic.
Yep.
The acting was really, really good. If I had issues with it, you know, like you've already touched upon, I feel like the central metaphor got a little ham-fisted at times, especially when it was – when things were clear, sort of, you know, we understood the rules of the place, so we kind of get what that means in terms of its translation to the real world. But then characters would make sure that we got it by telling it to each other in dialogue, and I felt a lot of that was not necessarily necessary. But it definitely went some places I wasn't expecting it to. And like you said, without spoiling the last act, my only issue with the movie really was the same thing about another movie that we very vehemently disagree on, Snowpiercer, where I felt like the movie at some point sort of abandoned the internal consistency of the rules of the world that it set up in favor of this allegorical ending that said what it needed to say, but then violated the internal consistency of the rules of the world.
Yeah, this one got a lot of comparisons, obviously, to Snowpiercer, whereas Snowpiercer is a horizontal train, this is a vertical tower. But thematically, they share a lot of messages and ideas.
Should we talk about, so did we decide that In the Tall Grass was scientific enough?
Sure, it's tangentially scientific because, I mean, if you're trapped in a giant field of grass, you're surrounded by chlorophyll, and that's science.
Well, there's also some time travel-y sort of elements.
Yeah, let's just do it real quick. In the Tall Grass is a novella adaptation. It's a dark horror story written by Stephen King and Joe Hill and adapted for the screen for Netflix by Vincenzo Natali, who I just mentioned as the director of Cube. And a lot of horror fans know him from Splice and Haunt, and he's one of my favorite directors. He's not flashy or, you know, a lot of people don't, he's not an impactful, like, blockbuster guy, but I think he gets horror, and he is really good at what he does. I'm a big Vincenzo Natali fan. In the Tall Grass is about an kind of obnoxious grown brother and sister who wander into a field of tall grass after hearing a small boy's voice calling from inside. They get hopelessly lost, and then it gradually becomes evident that they're not lost in a strictly traditional sense. They are lost in a metaphysical and otherworldly sense as well. And whereas I generally prefer the Stephen King horrors that are a bit more literal, you know, there's a killer car, there's a killer dog, you know, like I like that stuff because I feel like when he gets metaphysical and spacey, you can kind of write yourself out of anything. But for the most part, I think this film keeps the mystery percolating. It has some shocking moments of horror that work real well and some very good performances from actors I don't know very well. The only person I know in this film is Patrick Wilson, who is good, but the whole cast is great.
The other lead actor, the ex-boyfriend or whatever that comes, the baby daddy,
yeah,
was the tech genius in the movie we covered last week, Upgrade.
Oh, okay. Now I see it. Yeah. Good call. Okay.
And he was there at the festival. I saw him.
Yeah. What's your tall on grass?
I mean, it's so Stephen King. It almost feels like a Stephen King Mad Libs of like, you know, a group of strangers gets trapped in a blank. including a blank, a, you know, a pregnant mother, a brother and sister, a young family, and which again is not necessarily bad. I think what it does, so I have not read the original short story, but I did sort of read a synopsis after I'd seen the movie. And I think what this movie does with that source material is very similar to Children of the Corn, where it's this very sort of evocative kind of like, you don't really know what's going on in this place by the end of the story in the source material. And then in the movie, they kind of go on, they you know, they add a second and third act that changes a lot of sort of what's happening in the story and makes things a little bit more literal in some ways. So, you know, I certainly enjoyed it a lot. I thought the production design, again, was really, really good. I loved these shots of the grass waving, and it was very, it's a very eerie sort of environment in a way that you wouldn't expect to be.
Yeah, that's a good point. Visually speaking, obviously a film needs a lot more than just visually speaking, but if you're directing a film that takes place 90% inside of a field of grass, you need a director and production designer and DP and team who know how to find interesting angles. Otherwise, you're just looking at the exact same blowing grass for 90 minutes. And even if your movie is great, that's going to get boring. Yeah. And Natale and his team find really cool ways to shoot this field and shoot this like green sea. It's crazy.
And to make you feel the sort of disorientation that they feel in it.
Yep, yep. I saw one, I don't know if you did, Stephen, unless you were sitting right next to me, so sorry, a horror sci-fi film from Ireland called Sea Fever.
Yes. Was I sitting next to you for that one? I don't think I was, but I did see it.
You may have been. It was right after The Platform. As anybody who follows my work as a critic knows, I have a real soft spot for Ireland because in the last 5, 6, 7 years, they've banged out a quiet but strong number of really good horror films. And this one stars Connie Nielsen and Dougray Scott as the owners of a fishing trawler. And they are trying desperately, they're hard on money, and they're trying desperately to get a really good catch before they're forced back to land for a variety of reasons, be it weather or they're in a restricted area where they're not supposed to be boating through. And they have an expert on board, conveniently enough, a parasite expert who informs them that...
College student.
Yeah, college student. And they quickly come to discover that there is an unknown biological agent on board that leads to some really creepy bio-horror. And what I like about this one is that it plays kind of like an American B-movie about biological horror that comes up from the ocean. But it's done here with an actual sense of pacing, humanity, kind of restraint. And it plays a bit more realistic, but it takes its time with the characters, and it's not like nonstop horror where people are just getting splattered left and right. It lets you think about it. It lets you think about the people who are infected and what it's done to them. And it's moody, but it also has some really good, creepy moments. I dug Sea Fever.
I really liked it too. It's one of those things where I spent the remainder of the week trying to figure out how to describe this to people because I feel like the way it was described to me was really inaccurate. Somebody, you know, it was described as like Alien, but on a boat, which I think is a very unfair description of it because it's...
I guess in the most cursory way possible, sure. But you could find a dozen or two dozen much more apt comparisons. Although, to be fair, if you were to say something like, oh, it's a bit like, do you remember that movie Virus with Jamie Lee Curtis and Donald Sutherland? It's a little like that. Well, then you're not doing Sea Fever any favors.
Yeah, well, and the other comparison that jumps to my mind is the other Fever movie, which is Cabin Fever, which is really not doing it in its favor.
No, as a matter of fact, it wouldn't surprise me one bit if whoever acquires this for America changes the title.
Yeah, but you know, this is one of those ones where, like you with Vast of Night, I want to watch it again because I feel like I didn't get what I was expecting the first time, and so that hindered my ability to enjoy it as much as I feel like I would have had I been able to watch it a little bit more cleanly. So I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it again. The acting is fantastic.
Yep.
The writing is really, really good. You know, the characters are all very well drawn, and it's a very interesting story. It's definitely worth seeking out and watching. So,
yep. Let's move on to another really interesting film from filmmakers that I know a lot of sci-fi fans have come to love over the last few years. That is Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. They're back with their fourth film. Their first was Resolution. Their second was Spring. Their third was The Endless. And this is their fourth one. It's about two paramedics who discover that people are dying from a horrific new drug called Synchronic.
Yes.
What do you think?
I love the central premise of this movie, and I don't feel like it's a spoiler to say that what this drug does is it essentially allows people to travel through time. Not even travel through time, but sort of randomly be.
Yeah, involuntarily.
Like involuntarily, their body will phase into a different time in the past. And, you know, obviously that's extremely dangerous because when you go back to pretty much any point in the past, your chances of dying like spike rather rapidly. And so that's the reason why these guys end up discovering it is because they're paramedics and they get called to these places where people are, have either been grievously injured or have been killed because they've been, you know, stabbed by a conquistador. It takes place in Louisiana. And, you know, they've traveled back to the 1600s and been stabbed by a conquistador with a sword and, you know, or various other misadventures. And so I really, really like that. I love the effects that they use to sort of show the people phasing in and out.
What I like about this one is that it offers a kind of outlandish premise, but it doesn't waste time sitting around talking about it so the audience can kind of pick holes in it.
Yeah.
It moves quick. Again, this one's only about 90 minutes, and it has a lot of interesting ideas about addiction and recovery and violence, and the time travel stuff is pretty damn interesting, and they pull it off cleverly. I mean, it's not a big budget movie, but they pull off some lofty ideas and interesting effects really well.
And, you know, added to that is there's an undercurrent that's never really sort of made explicit, but, well, you know, it's made explicit in various underplayed ways, you know, because Anthony Mackie obviously is an African-American man in Louisiana in 2019. Life is much less dangerous than it is for an African-American man in Louisiana at literally any point in the past. And so when he starts traveling back in time, things are sort of extra dangerous for him as a black man in Louisiana. And the film kind of plays with that and has that sort of thematic thrust in a lot of the stuff.
Yeah, it'll be out. It'll probably be out early next year. And if you're a fan of their earlier films, I think that you will definitely dig this one. And I am just, they're just, I know them personally. You know them. They're just sweet, humble, funny guys who look like game show hosts. But they're like, they do. They're both ridiculously handsome. Let's just admit it. They are.
Okay, I wasn't sure what that exactly.
Oh, God, come
yes,
on.
They are
Moorhead
very handsome.
Moorhead Benson, handsome bastards. And they also, but they have the brains of like the biggest sci-fi nerds you could imagine. And they write stuff that doesn't give easy answers. And they,
well, and they don't ever lose sight of characters in the face of the big ideas that their movies are putting forward. And that to me is what I like most about them. In The Endless and in Spring and in this movie, there are big ideas at play, but the characters are what's important. And whether you care about them and whether you care about the journey that they're going on is what drives the movie and not just the sort of big, lofty science fiction.
Okay, what do you got next, Steve?
So I want to talk about a much smaller movie called Worm, W-Y-R-M.
Okay, all yours. I've heard good things, but I've not seen it. Go.
So I'm including it because I really, really liked the movie. It's only very, 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 very loosely could be considered science fiction anyway. It's, you know, it's in sort of what I would guess I would call probably an alternate reality. And in this alternate reality, teenagers, or in particular our middle school protagonist and his twin sister, are given collars that will only unlock themselves when they have kissed another person. And so, you know, our protagonist is at the beginning of ninth grade, and he's basically the only kid left in his entire grade that hasn't, that still has his collar, and it's sort of an embarrassment, and it's a literalization of this idea of not being cool, you know, in high school, or not being sexually.
Right, or maybe assuming that you're definitely the only virgin in school, right, and you feel awful.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that is the only sort of science fiction-y kind of element of the thing. The rest of it is very much sort of a very quirky dramedy. Honestly, the first half hour felt a little too quirky for me. It reminds me of a way less cynical Napoleon Dynamite. Whereas Napoleon Dynamite, I feel like, hated all of its characters and was just relentlessly talking down to them. This movie, you know, it's quirky in that similar sort of way, but without the condescension and with, you know, where you really sort of care about them. And then it turns in the end. So in the background of this whole story is, you know, this twin brother and sister, their older brother died in a car accident at some recent point in the past, you know, before the movie started. And so they're sort of dealing with the grief of that, and their parents, who have both gone absent during this critical time for them. And so they're kind of being raised by their uncle and his new girlfriend a little bit. And it's very, again, it's very character driven. It's very sort of rich. It is quirky to a point, but then it really, really develops a very strong heart. And it, you know, it had me misty-eyed by the end of the movie, and it tied up all these sort of disparate threads of like the collar and the living with the, you know, the parents being gone and the brother dying and his relationship with his twin sister, which is strained, and he sort of tied them all up very well by the end of the movie, not in a sort of neat bow, but in a very, in a way that felt very
satisfying,
thought through and satisfying. Right. And, you know, by the end of the movie, I don't know, it's weirdly sort of, for as quirky and as unrealistic as the world that they've set up is, it ends up feeling kind of like a slice of life movie, which is my favorite sort of genre, honestly.
Great. Keep an ear out for that one. It's Wyrm, W-Y-R-M. Only tangentially sci-fi, maybe, you know, alternate reality speculation. That counts. That definitely counts. And here's one we'll cover very briefly for two reasons. One, it stars two people I know who are personal friends of mine. They recently worked on a movie that I produced called I Trap the Devil. They're both ridiculously talented actors, but I don't want to sit here and wax their car because they are personal friends. They made a film called Night Drive, which is it stars A.J. Bowen as a rideshare driver. And he picks up a woman played by Sophie Dalla, and they go on a series of calm but amusing misadventures where she is deceiving him almost at every turn, but he is just amiable and wants to get a 5-star rating and get move on to the next ride. But she keeps extending the ride, and then eventually a third character is introduced named Frank, who was played by Scott Poitras, who was the lead in I Trap the Devil. And he plays a very small but important role in this movie where he gets hit by the ride share car. And then Sophie and Russell have to figure out what they're going to do with this body they accidentally, hit. And this doesn't sound like anything like science fiction, but somewhere around the middle of Act 2 or the beginning of Act 3, a very distinct sci-fi theme is introduced, and I won't say exactly what it is, because if you watch this film when it comes out, you might be pleasantly surprised. But suffice to say that it is a funny kind of neo-noir, all takes place in one night, the unwitting guy tries to be kind to a potentially dangerous woman, and she leads him on a series of weird misadventures that leads to a sci-fi climax. And I might be biased because I love AJ and Scott so much, and that might have been part of my enjoyment was watching them on the screen again, but this also holds up for me as just a fun, diverting little sci-fi comedy.
So my last two are not science fiction movies.
Okay. Oh, I got a few of those as well. But yeah, let's keep these one quick.
Very barely. You know, I'm qualifying them as having sci-fi elements mainly because I want to put them on people's radar. And the first of those is The Mortuary Collection, which is an absolutely terrific horror anthology by Ryan Spindel, who made an incredible short film called The Babysitter Murders, which is one of the stories that becomes part of this anthology that was playing on the festival circuit around the same time as Found Footage 3D. So I got to watch it numerous times. And, you know, here's how good this movie is. It's a 25-minute long short film. And if you know anything about film festivals, you know that programming 25-minute long short films is a thing that basically never happens, because you could put five-minute short films in that period of time, or 2 12-minute short films. And so you have to have something that is exceptionally good for them to want to block out 25 minutes just for that one film. This film played like several dozen film festivals and absolutely deserved to, because it's just one of the most top-notch pieces of filmmaking I have ever seen from a first-time director. And the anthology lives up to that completely. I think the best way to describe it is it feels like a hard R, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. It's got that sort of sense of wonder and that very Spielbergian camera movement, sort of innocence of childhood sort of thing going for it. But then it's really gory and really brutal in places. And so one of the stories involves an octopus that apparently lives inside a bathroom vanity, a medicine cabinet mirror thing, and a woman that encounters this thing. And so I'm calling that just science fiction enough for me to be able to mention this movie, so that people will go and watch it.
All right. It was one of probably my biggest miss. I'm going to be getting a screener of it. I can't wait to see it, but it was up against other stuff both times, and it just bugged me. I'm going to run through a few here that aren't sci-fi at all in any way, but I want to recommend them. The Amazing Parasite from Bong Joon-ho. Definitely see that. A strange kind of film noir slash musical slash dark teen melodrama called Knives and Skin, from a director, Jennifer Reed, are really interesting. There's a film from Italy which is a slow burn, but it is ice cold. It's called The Last to See Them, which I liked. A French film from the director of Rubber called Deerskin, and I am very hot and cold on Mr. Quentin Dupieux. I think that's how it's pronounced.
Yep.
I think Deerskin might be his best film, or at least my favorite of his films. It's about a weirdo who gets himself a deerskin suit and then decides he has to be the only person in his world who owns a jacket. And then he goes about taking away everybody else's jacket. It's bizarre, but it is his most conventional film yet. And the metaphor basically for greed and sexism and, well, toxic maleness. There are all kinds of interesting ideas in this movie. Deerskin, I definitely liked. Steven, could we talk just for a minute about Dolomite Is My Name?
You can talk for as long as you'd like about Dolomite Is My Name.
I love this movie. I know it's a big Netflix title. To me, that doesn't matter. This movie could come out from Paramount, IFC. I don't care. That stuff doesn't matter to me. This is a beautiful film from the writers of Ed Wood, from the director of Hustle and Flow. And even if you don't know who Rudy Ray Moore, a.k.a. Dolomite, is, that's fine. This movie will not only introduce you to him, but will also wrap you in the sense of community that independent filmmakers often feel when they're working with people they care about and they're working on stuff they like.
Yeah.
I can always use a good film that honors good quality independent filmmakers. And this movie does that. It is a love letter to the, hey, let's make a movie kind of mentality of good people. Eddie Murphy is great. Wesley Snipes is great. The whole cast is great. Loved it.
Yeah, I really, really, obviously really enjoyed this movie. Anything about indie filmmaking. It's similar to my Napoleon Dynamite comparison earlier. This kind of feels like a much more good-natured disaster artist, where again, like, you understand that all these characters actually really sort of love each other, that they're following this central character because they believe in him and they believe in his vision and they believe in the joy of making movies. Whereas obviously the disaster artist is about people who followed this lunatic to make a movie despite their misgivings. So this one, it would make an interesting double feature with that movie just in terms of...
Definitely it would. Steven, give a little description of this bizarre film called Come to Daddy.
You know what? Honestly, no. Because I feel like to describe this movie in any way whatsoever would be to give away too much. I'll say just go see it.
Yeah, all right. Here it is in a nutshell. Elijah Wood plays a strange man who goes to visit his estranged father, as played by Stephen McHattie, in a bizarre house that looks like a spaceship. And he starts to discover all sorts of truly unpleasant things about his family history. And I'll just leave it at that, right?
Yeah. I mean, the movie takes two or three just hard left turns.
Yep.
That, again, to even saying that is almost spoiling it. But it, whatever kind of movie you think it is, it's only that for about 20 minutes, and then it becomes an entirely different kind of movie.
It's a dark comedy for a bit, and then it's kind of a psycho thriller for a bit, and then it's a satire about, like, familial relations and estranged and parents getting older. And
Haunted House movie.
Haunted House, yep. It is the directorial debut of a friend of mine named Ant Timpson, who is a New Zealand nut. He's produced a lot, but this is his first film as a director, and obviously I think he is a talented guy. So he went from, like, a festival regular and a festival programmer to a producer, and now he's directing. And I know a lot of people who've done that, and I'm very proud of Ant. I think he's done a great job on this one. What about The Lodge, Steve? What do you think of The Lodge?
You know what? Man, so Goodnight Mommy is top five all-time horror movies for me. I love that movie. That was a secret screening a couple years ago, and I had no idea what I was getting into. I just sat down. I saw the German title, knew nothing about it, and it just floored me. So,
all right. So I think that we're both going to agree that The Lodge is not quite as impressive as Goodnight Mommy. Is that where we're heading?
Unfortunately. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So why don't you sum up what it's about real quick?
Well, so it's about, you know what, again, this is another one where it feels hard to sum it up without giving too much away, but it's, you know, at its base, it is about a father who is marrying a new woman, a younger woman, and his two young kids, played by the kid from It, Bill Denbrow from It, and I believe a newcomer playing the young girl. The father decides to take all of them out to this hunting lodge in the Great White North. I'm not even sure what country it is. I think it's Canada, probably in Canada.
Yep.
So that the two kids can warm to their new stepmother. and they do not warmed her. So let's just leave it at that.
Yeah. I mean, it works as a postmodern fairy tale adaptation. It works as the most extreme metaphor you could have for like children afraid of their upcoming step parent, and then twisting that to the most ridiculous degree. And it's fun. I enjoyed this quite a bit.
It is fun. It's a really good movie. I went into it obviously with expectations that were unrealistic. And so, it's another one that I just need to see it again. I was so high on my anticipation list that I think I probably cock-blocked it.
Let me run through a few more films with like two sentences each. And I want us to close on the closing night film because it's just so much fun. The Pool is a film from Thailand, and it's one of those trapped in a blank, you know, like Buried was Ryan Reynolds trapped in a coffin or Kiefer Sutherland trapped in a phone booth.
Frozen, people trapped on a ski lift.
Well, this is a young man trapped in an empty pool, and it doesn't have like a ladder that he can just climb up.
Like a giant Olympic-sized swimming pool.
Yeah, yeah. Imagine you're in a pool that goes from like, you know, 12 feet deep to 30 feet deep. How are you going to climb out of that? You know, and it's a simple idea. And then it's made much worse by the fact that the guy's dog is up there and he has to get out and try and feed his dog. Then there's a crocodile that comes by. Then eventually his girlfriend comes looking for him. Does she get stuck in the pool? Maybe, maybe not. And it's just, it's wacky, but it's fun. Yeah. Then we get Fractured from Brad Anderson, the director of many years ago. He did Session 9 and lots of good genre films. And this is another slightly more conventional Netflix production in which Sam Worthington plays a guy who drops his wife and daughter off to get a CAT scan after a nasty accident. And then he comes back to the hospital and dun, 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 they're gone. Nobody has any recollection of his wife and daughter. So either they got stolen and everyone's lying to him, or it's something in his head, or maybe it's something else. And I had fun with this, although it, again, like In the Shadow of the Moon, the Netflix production with this indie director, and it feels like they're asking these indie directors that we love to be slightly more mainstream and slightly more conventional with their horror and their thrillers. And with that regard, I think Brad Anderson is just a good director. And even though this is kind of a more predictable and conventional script, he does some interesting things with it. So there's Fractured, pretty decent. Then we got After Midnight, which is a bizarre but very interesting romantic drama from Jeremy Gardner and Christian Stella, who directed several years ago a film called The Battery, which is a really interesting kind of ruminative zombie movie with more dialogue than gore. And I mean that as a compliment. And this is a film about a lonely guy who is desperately missing his beloved girlfriend, as played by Brea Grant, and co-director Jeremy Gardner plays the lead. And while he misses her desperately, he becomes convinced that a monster is visiting his house every night. So he is like setting himself up with traps and weapons and whatnot to catch this monster. And what will happen to the alleged monster if and when his girlfriend comes back? It's funny. It's very well acted. It has a great ending, in my opinion. So that's After Midnight. Then we saw an insane Russian film called Why Don't You Just Die?
Oh, that was gonna be the one that I was gonna make sure I mentioned.
All right, all right, you take this one, Stephen. I loved it, but I want to let you take it.
I mean, it's almost so impossible to describe. It is about a kid, a young man who goes to the house of his girlfriend at her behest to murder her father, and he is a police officer. Who
a shady police officer
fights back. Yeah. Yes, a very corrupt police officer. And so the entire thing takes place over the course of a couple hours with a few flashbacks in, you know, of these two of them in this epic square off, trying to essentially kill one another. And it is brutal and incredibly gory and hilarious from beginning to end.
Yeah, it is a blast. It is the director of this feels like he was inspired by everything from early Coen brothers to classic film noir and Hitchcock suspense, Looney Tunes violence with Sam Raimi. Gore. And it is just, you can tell that the filmmakers are having fun kind of combining all these disparate genres into a film that really cooks and keeps moving and doesn't slow down. And what I like is that there's a lot of violence and action kind of fighting in the first half. And then the flashbacks kind of settled down into a bit more plot-driven. And I thought, all right, if it's just going to be action scene flashback, that's going to get really kind of tiresome by hour two. And the director realizes this, and he's not like, all right, well, when I come back to the contemporary scenes without the flashbacks, we have to do more than just conk people on the head with a brick. There needs to be some actual stakes and threads. And I think it has like five characters all told.
Yeah.
And they just keep bouncing off each other in very unpleasant and darkly humorous ways. I definitely one of the best of the festival. Why Don't You Just Die with an exclamation point. From Russia, I absolutely love this movie. What do you got, Steve?
My last one that I would want to mention is a movie called Nobody, and that's spelled N-O-B-A-D-I because it's, I think it might be a German movie. It takes place in Austria, but one or the other. It's a German language movie.
They're neighbors.
Yeah, that takes place in Austria. No joke, if I teach screenwriting, I will show the first 30 minutes of this movie to my class because it is a masterclass in how to set up two characters through action. It's, you know, the gist of the story is that a young man from Afghanistan who is in the country illegally gets hired by this old, like super old 90-year-old guy to dig a hole in his backyard to bury his dead dog. The old guy is racist as hell. He is xenophobic as hell. He may or may not have been a Nazi prison guard at some point in his past. And the two of them sort of do not like each other at all at the beginning of this movie, but they're introduced in such a fascinating way. And it's really sort of a two-hander between these two guys. And you think it's going to be, you know, if this had been an awards movie, it would have been about them learning to find their common humanity and bond with one another and discover that deep down they're all the same, which is kind of what happens, but it happens in the most fantastic fest way possible. And it gets super violent, not really violent, it gets super gory and explicit in the second half. And it goes some places you would never sort of expect. You think it's going to be a heartwarming drama. And in a weird way, it sort of is, but not in the way that you would ever expect it to be. So it's not a movie for the faint of heart, but it was absolutely fantastically written and fantastically acted. And
wonderful.
Definitely something you should watch.
The key word of this episode is fantastic.
Yep.
Because we keep both saying it, because we're both looking at a list that says Fantastic Fest on it. We're going to close out with a film that is in no way science fiction, but we don't care because it's our podcast. And if you're still listening, you want to know, hey, Scott, Steven, how is this Knives Out murder mystery that I'm hearing so much about with this crazy cast from the director of Looper and Last Jedi? Is it the bee's knees? Is it better than Ready or Not? Or is it just another retread of an Agatha Christie format? I'm here to tell you this is one of the most entertaining murder mysteries I've ever seen. This movie's, what, 2 hours and 15 minutes? And I could have taken another 15, 20 minutes. It's that much fun. It works as a mystery. It works as a satirical indictment of the super wealthy. It is beautiful. And we're not going to get into any type of plot except to say that the patriarch of a wealthy, obnoxious family has passed away, and it is up to two cops and a very brilliant detective to figure out if foul play is afoot, and if so, who done it?
Which is, incidentally, almost identical to the setup of the most recent Adam Sandler, Jennifer Aniston movie on Netflix called Murder Mystery.
Good Lord, Steve. You know, I know you're super sensitive about spoilers, and this opens up at the end of next month, so we don't want to...
I want to know nothing. I've avoided all the trailers. I don't want to know anything about it.
Oh, you weren't out there. That's right. You went to see something else. Good man.
Yep. I did not see it, so don't tell me anything more.
Yeah, I'll leave it at that. If you saw the trailer or a commercial for Knives Out and you thought, hey, this looks like it might be fun, I am here to tell you, you are right.
So apparently the audience agreed with you because it was the runner-up for the audience award behind Parasite.
Yeah.
Which is rare at Fantastic Fest for a big movie to get an audience award.
Our original plan was to release this episode as a Patreon episode. And then Steven said, hey, better for the show, better for our listeners, and better for the festival if we put this up on our main feed. And I thought about it for about 9 seconds and I went, you're right. So that's why this is not a traditional episode. If you're listening to this, hey, why don't you just go back and listen to Upgrade versus Venom? We just did that. That's a fun episode. But thank you so much for listening to this long but essential episode. Thank you to Fantastic Fest for being great. And thank you, Steven, for running through all these movies with me.
It was a pleasure. I'm glad that we are able to bring some of these movies to the attention of people that might not otherwise be aware of their existence. And so seek some of these out.
And if you can, make it out to Austin next year and you can say hi to us yourselves. As always, thank you for listening. Science versus Fiction.
Goodbye.